Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
And good evening, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and this is a show that explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Monday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. And tonight we have another very special guest, I should say. There have been a lot of great guests as of late, but we have a really important topic tonight. We're going to talk about prioritizing mental health in cancer treatment. This is really something that we don't talk about. It's sort of still, you know, very hush-hush in terms of the reality, what people's lives look like. And with the increasing diagnoses of cancer and the increasing diagnoses of mental health disorders, I think it's a very important topic. So my guest tonight is Dr. Cheatham Coyle. She's a psychologist who specializes in anxiety and psycho-oncology, which we'll talk about that in a minute. Welcome, Dr. Coyle.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us tonight to discuss this topic I know you're very passionate about.
Thank you.
And I know you have a lot of training and education to share with us.
Yes.
So let's just get started. Tell me, what exactly is a psycho-oncologist?
Kim, let me talk about what is psycho-oncology is before I start what is psycho-oncology, specialist psychologist.
Sure, go ahead.
Psycho-oncology is a multidisciplinary field integrating oncology, radiology, and palliative care. And it focuses on psychological aspects of cancer. The psychological responses of cancer patients, families, and caretakers at all stages of the disease, and the psychological, behavioral, and social factors that may influence the disease process.
Okay.
So you also maybe see in your clinical setting, due to some societal stigma, and the lack of psycho-oncology clinicians and the resources, many cancer patients still keep their condition hidden, as you mentioned at the beginning.
Okay. So I'm guessing that the first real intersection with a person with a cancer diagnosis often may be through a clinical or hospital setting. And
yes.
You work at Hoag in Newport and at St. Joseph's in Orange.
Member.
As a member, as an affiliated member, mm-hmm. as a part of the treatment team there, yes?
I am a medical staff, but I work outpatient in my office.
And you have a private practice in Newport Beach, is that
yes.
correct? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so a person is going along in life and they discover they have this sort of a, you know, often scary at times, I can't imagine it isn't at any point, diagnosis. And that is delivered by whom? Let's just walk through the process for people so they understand. I want to stick to the mental health part, but let's say, you know, if I'm the patient, I'm with you, you're my doctor. Mm-hmm. What happens now for me?
Yes, I usually get my cancer patient referrals from hospital settings okay. to my office, of course. And when they first came, depends on their diagnosis. Six stages, I have a different way of approaching it. If they are in end-of-life stage versus they are just newly diagnosed, I experience that the newly diagnosed one experiences more anxiety, more looking forward to fill it in with informations. As well as their depression also kicks in. They sometimes mix. Mm-hmm. You can't really differentiate which way. But the end of life stage cancer patients, what I'm experiencing in my office is more about no longer anxiety, but more about depression and how to say goodbye and feeling more guilt that leaving loved one behind.
Okay. Okay. So that makes sense. So you're going to be receiving different levels of patients in terms of where they are in their diagnoses. Now, do patients, are they really spoken to by their doctors initially about mental health care? How do they find you in the first place? Do these referrals, do doctors tend to talk about these issues with patients?
That's a very good question. Actually, I've been referred by, as I said, from either oncologists or palliative care doctors. I've been experiencing very good results with oncologists, me and palliative care doctors, you know, that triangle working hands on hands in some of the cases last year. One of them refer me because I go do case presentations or give lectures about the latest findings in cancer settings in terms of psycho-oncology. Mm-hmm. So they do know my name. That's how they give my name.
Okay.
That's how I see them, or else, you know, there's hardly a newly diagnosed one. They just don't come to me right away. There is no that kind of a system yet.
Right. Okay, so there really isn't a real protocol in place. It might depend on the doctor and sort of how they're approaching mental health care for their cancer patients?
Exactly. If they are willing and being open and they know that there is a psycho-oncology component might be exist up front without knowing, they can, you know, without discussing, they can give my name.
Okay.
Or they are struggling with mental health severely, or they even refer for their pain issues to palliative care. From there, I get referral.
So I kind of find that hard to believe. I mean, I think this has been an evolution, but that you don't, you know, of course, if your body is sick with cancer, how can that not affect your brain and your mind and your heart and your soul? It just blows my mind that we are so far behind. I found a quote that said a cancer diagnosis can be as devastating to the psyche as the cancer is to the body. And
exactly.
So, right, we haven't really talked about that, which really goes back to even, you know, me being a psychologist, I don't think that we talk a lot about being about psycho-oncology. How did you come to discover, you know, what it would mean to be a psycho-oncologist, and what did it take for you to become trained to do so?
Yes, from my actually personal life, like many of us probably been in, you know, touched by cancer around our either loved ones or personal stories. I mean, it's all around us now. It's not rare anymore. I had many, many friends and family members. Some of them passed away. Some of them are survivors. Been through very hard struggle dealing with cancer. And the psychological help was very lacking at that time. Me as a caregiver, even, I had a hard time, and I'm a psychologist myself. You know, we can treat ourselves very easy.
What?
And that was the one component. The second component is that my doctoral degree emphasis in health psychology, which we treat medical problems affecting mental health. That was the other component. And in years to come, I kind of started looking at putting these two together with my experiences coming being a helper to all my loved ones, and how do I take care of their psychological issues to being a health psychologist. And then started looking at where am I getting this training from. And that was the interesting point that I had to look around and couldn't find. And I went all the way to New York to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Yeah. And I got a couple of trainings from there. One for one is called Meaning Center Psychotherapy for Advanced Cancer Patients. They are the one created this. Eight structured sessions to connect the patients back into life and back into the you know, meaning in life. Sometimes when you get this hit by this kind of a serious disorder diagnosis, you might lose meaning in life or displace somewhere differently and react differently. And that can cause depression, anxiety, all kinds of stuff. And the second one I got was, it's called acute cancer cognitive therapy treatment for cancer patients. After that, I just followed their treatment advertisement and education trainings, and I go there. And psycho-oncology actually stemmed from Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and Massachusetts General Hospital long, long ago in 1960s, I think. So I think this is the good place to start with.
Makes sense. So there are places to receive training, but it sounds like it's still very limited.
Maybe there is a room, I am not aware, but I just went all the way up there to get from the area where it started from.
Okay. So let's go back to, you were saying, and not really necessarily the meaning-driven part, but because I think that's important, we could talk probably a lot about that. But where does cancer, let's discuss where cancer starts to impact all the different areas of a person's life.
Yes.
Right? So let's walk through, you know, we talked about their dating life and their family life, their job, their financial lives. Let's talk about that. What do you see in your practice?
Of course, it's as you mentioned, it starts from the relationship point, the work, finance, dating, your spouse, husband, wife relationships, kids, your kids, everything, all around you. Cancer is not a person's, you know, diagnosis. It's diagnosed of all the people all around as a huge network that needs to be addressed. I hear things like from a breast cancer young lady coming that, you know, she got a double mastectomy and saying that how I'm going to say that to, you know,
to a dating my partner, right?
Boyfriend, or right. I just like this guy, and how I'm going to say that.
Wow.
And the guy comes with, you know, testicle cancer,
mm-hmm.
Or something like, you know, how I'm going to date now. Is my relationship or future goals of, you know, relating with others are over now? And, you know, these are very important questions. These are important things to put things in perspective. Also the financial parts that plays a lot of role, especially maybe in this talk we're going to talk about, that can be contributing one of the suicidal ideations that, you know, the cancer treatments are expensive.
So what about insurance? What is the issue with insurance and cancer treatment? Why is it so expensive?
You know, they have some sort of a conventional standard treatments, as I'm understanding. But if you needed to go for alternatives or FDA not approved or something needs to be clinical trial, and insurance companies usually, I am not sure that they will say yes.
So what would you say are the percentage of people who have to pay significant out-of-pocket expenses? I know it varies based on what kind of cancer and things like that, but how often is that the case?
I wouldn't know right now, but from our cases, we were taking second mortgages or, you know, copays are not like $30, $40 or something like your copays can come something like thousands of dollars.
Right.
Imagine that. How can that impact in your family finance?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the patients who are getting treated with chemo and radiation and all, they are not that much of a capability to jumping, go back to work and start producing money.
Yeah, it can be very exhausting and people don't feel well. And so that, how do you take a leave of absence?
You start from part-time and, you know, you're having most likely fatigues and all kinds of other, you know, disabling kind of situations you're facing at that point. That's the financial parts of it. But, you know, as I said, the relationship, maybe aspects of relationship is the one that really hits people.
That makes sense.
It can change because you are switching now from being someone capable of doing everything to all those treatment times, your caregiver, your spouse or someone else has to take over your responsibility of doing things you used to. This shift causes a lot of disorientation and adjustment situation.
Do you find that there's a burnout point with people? I mean, even with caregivers, I think it's like most things in life. You know, like I'll support you when you're going through something hard, but when your hard goes on and on and on and difficult, I think people, caregivers, can burn out. And I imagine that could be even harder. You feel more, even more isolated. And
absolutely. Yeah. Caregivers needs to be, you know, paid attention because everything focused on, you know, patient, of course, and they are well-being. But if caregivers are not well enough, how are they going to take care the cancer patient? You know, that is another thing. When they, you know, burned out doing everything for their own job, top of that, you know, taking care of, going all the doctor visits, everything. And after, you know, all the side effects they have to deal, sometimes, you know, they are having fear that how are they going to be good enough? Mm-hmm. Is it good enough? Are they enough giving, or are they lacking so many responsibilities and scared situations, caregivers also, you know, carrying on their shoulder at that time?
Yes, and I can imagine as a caregiver, you don't want to put that on your loved one. And so you have to find a way to deal with that. You know, you're both sort of in your own little worlds, yes, dealing with your different responses to this diagnosis.
Absolutely. Right. That's right.
So what are the most frequent diagnoses that you see with cancer, you know, treatment problems or just the experiences? I'm assuming, obviously, a lot of anxiety and depression. What do you tend to see the most?
Mostly I'm seeing depression, actually. The newly diagnosed ones are not much coming to me. As I mentioned it, you know, it needs some sort of an education and system access into when you're newly diagnosed. You know, there is an access to get treatment from a psycho-oncology trained person. Mm-hmm. What I am seeing usually is anxiety, not necessarily anxiety, I'm sorry, more like depression and post-traumatic stress disorders, some comorbid, you know, situation. There is, you know, past severe depression related, another, you know, comorbid situation has occurred in the history, had some suicidal attempts or serious thoughts. That stems from, you know, current serious cancer diagnoses, and it becomes, you know, lively again, and they start rehashing their past traumas again.
Right. Yes, I'm imagining that pre-existing trauma and existing conditions, you know, definitely would have an impact on,
yes,
you've already had a hard life or something, and now you have this to deal with. And so I can only imagine how much more difficult that is for people. And to also be able to seek treatment and, you know, even reach out again, thinking, I don't want to go through that again. I've already been to therapy, mm-hmm, or never having been to therapy and not even knowing what they can benefit by going. I'm sure it's a wide range of responses.
There are very wide range responses. For example, one of the patients was rejecting to operation and needed the operation, breast cancer operation. That's how she came to me. And then I found out that in the past, she had a sexual harassment when she was hospitalized. Oh. And she was having fear of it's going to reoccur again. And those kind of things, you know, can prevent them to make rational, realistic decision. You know, cognitive therapy plays a lot of role of reversing these thoughts to, you know, priority of, you know, you will lose your life if you don't get this thing done. Right. You know, how we can, you know, think of it that maybe differentiate that past trauma may, mm-hmm, not possibly reoccur, and, you know, making some plans and comfort at the same time, making right decisions so that you will maintain quality life and stay alive.
Right. The patients I've seen, I mean, I'm not a specialist in psycho-oncology, but I've had, you know, a decent amount of patients who have struggled with either previous cancer diagnoses or current. They have this sort of panic about whatever I was doing in my life contributed to me getting cancer. And I'm terrified of being in a situation sort of that it will happen again. And so on the one hand, I think it's good because you're reevaluating your life and you're getting stronger and saying at some point as you progress, you know what, I'm not taking this anymore. It just doesn't work for me anymore. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they have this panic or fear that whatever I was doing, it was like I didn't eat organic or I smoked in college or, you know, I lived in a building with lead paint. I mean, it's really, or my relationship contributed. Can you talk about that a little bit and what you've seen?
Yes, there is, you know, some sort of a balance. It needs to be addressed at this point that every single glass of wine, for example, you drank, that doesn't mean that you are inviting cancer or something else. It just, some people I see in my practice that they've been eating and exercising, doing something religiously, they got cancer. Some people I do see that they don't do any other healthy route of living and they don't have cancer. So it is hard to say, you know, if you do this, this will be leading to cancer. If you don't do this, you will be, you know, healthy living. There is no such a, you know, straight cut line. Of course, we all aware of healthy living, exercise, eating healthy food and everything. But if you go overboard, reacting to the situations, I think you're moving into some sort of a mental health part of thing that you're dealing with.
Right.
You know, if you drink one glass of wine, next day you're having panic attack, cancer is coming, is not no longer approaching to a healthy way of living. You need to find the balance of comfort and quality living.
Right. But I think that's the hard part, is that we all know people who were, you know, they went to Whole Foods every day and they went to the gym every day and they got some crazy brain cancer. You know, I think that what's so scary about it for most of us is that, yes, we know that certain things can contribute, let's say like smoking or whatever, but to be honest, there are so many things that have nothing to do with anything. It's just random.
Yes.
And so I think that's what makes the word, the C word, as we used to say, still so scary for people, right? So you
exactly.
can really magnify that into your own life if you have the diagnosis.
Right, exactly.
Right. What do you think about having people do groups, and what's been your experience with people really seeking out support with people who have been through cancer themselves?
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine, and what I've seen, is it can be really helpful. And a lot of hospitals offer groups, I believe.
Yes.
What has been your experience with that, with sort of sharing your story with other people?
I don't know any groups as part of myself that I experience in terms of cancer patients. How do they experience the groups? But it's always out there and advertised. And if, they're interested in, they can go. But some of the patients that share with me, they don't really want to talk about their cancer and going group. That is, you know, preferences. And some of them share with me that it's very informative. It's really supportive. They learn a lot. If they are lonely, especially living alone in the house, there is nothing else to do. At least there is a group. Someone do understand what they are going through,
right,
so that they can connect and make some sort of a social friendship with them together. And sometimes they, some of them said they go out dinner together, mm-hmm. eat something mm-hmm. together. So it becomes a social aspect of it. Some of them are not ready for that. So it depends on the cancer patients, how they are approaching to it.
Right.
They don't want to listen. Some of them say, I don't want to hear it.
I can understand that. They're already living it so much, right?
Exactly. And because it can be traumatic some point.
Right.
Imagine that you're in a first stage and you're going there and seeing fourth stage or from a same cancer. And that can be need to be grouped differently.
Right.
By saying that, the informative groups and the social aspects of it can enrich patients' life as well.
I think that's a really good point, because you're right. Of course, if you're in one stage, let's say the beginning, and you go into a group that has not really been well vetted, and you have people who are much further along in the process, that can be scary. And also what I've seen is the forums, you know, on the internet, on the online communities, that
I think they are very good.
They can be great. I was reading that if they are moderated by a health practitioner, it's much more helpful, because it can be very scary. There can be, if there's just sort of free posting of anything and everything, people can get also flooded and overwhelmed with this information and that. So I think what you're saying before is there's a balance between finding the right fit and the appropriate sort of groups and treatment and information.
Yes, because I never been familiar with much of the group therapies in cancer settings and how it's functioning in hospital settings, I don't know. But mostly I'm seeing it's advertised giving information, which is can be very helpful for them to hear, and, you know, something that learn differently what to do and how to do and ask questions about it. But meantime, the ones are, you know, first stage or the fourth stage can be somewhat a conflict that they're for each other. I don't know if they never address that. I think it's mostly informative, but if it's the therapeutic group therapy setting, right, needs to be staged and approached differently.
Absolutely. Can you just walk us through, from a mental health perspective, what you see in the various stages of cancer in terms of people's issues, where they, you know, do they become to find more meaning? At what point do you see them struggle most? What is sort of the process of as they go through? And obviously you have cancers that are more easily treatable. Yes. But in general, can you tell us what that looks like?
The few I got last year, one of them really struck my mind was the fourth stage cancer, and was suicidal, and then lost all the meanings in life. There was nothing for him to, you know, go through. And with this meaning-centered psychotherapy technique that we approached and applied at that time, he reconnected back with the meaning in life. He started finding that even though you have a last minute in your life, you still can have approach differently to life and connect with something about it and get the meaning out of it, which I told them that it was in our manual from the Meaning Center Psychotherapy, that the suffering we can't control, but how we pursue towards suffering is in our hand. So he connected with many, many aspects of his life and became, you know, depression-free, suicidal-free. And something made wonders, you know, in life. And his treatment started working, and he's now cancer-free.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it just gives you, you know, mind-blowing things that you never know what's the next step in your life sometimes.
Right.
You approach into this is it. And, you know, I always tell them you're not a number. You're an individual, and you're, you know, cancer is not all represented, representing who you are. Mm-hmm. You are more than cancer. We don't lose the other aspects of who we are. We connect with that we lose it, because there's a giant sea in the room now in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But the other areas needs to be expanded and cultivated again. That's how you can live and enjoy your life. So the beginning, of course, is so many questions that needs to be answered by oncologists and their medical treatment team. My role at there is basically the reducing the anxiety down and making them appropriate approach and being collaborated with the treatment team.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously it does vary. So you can have somebody coming in and really being hopeless, and that evolving into being cancer-free and moving on with their life. And what have been the most profound changes you've seen in people as a result of, let's assume for the people who were able to survive cancer, what have you seen besides? Anything else, any other stories like that one you want to share?
Usually what I see is that how important the family members for them. that they lost the connection of it, even though before cancer, and it became now a new way of relating and finding the connection even richer than ever before. That's a very good reward and a gift coming out of that kind of a treatment. I mean, the cancer might be a bad diagnose and maybe have not a good taste in people's mind about it, but sometimes it teaches different aspects of who you are and straightening what really mean to you. And you never explored that before that you are experiencing now. Mm-hmm. Your identity sometimes changes and shifted. Mm-hmm. You really become more approaching today is just not just a day. It's just somewhat too many meanings and richness going on, and living here and now is becomes more important rather than, running through the days with not paying attention. You know, waking up in the morning, being alive, it becomes something that not many people can experience if they didn't go through some such struggle.
Right, right. Which I think that leads to our next conversation, which is when you're in something like that, it can feel so hopeless and there doesn't seem to be a point to go on, but you don't really know what lies ahead of you at times. But when people are in it, right, they feel like there's nothing ahead. And so I think that leads to our next topic, which is really the significantly increased rate of suicide among cancer patients.
Yes.
Can you share with us a little bit about that, please?
Yes. There is a recent study, actually, is very mind-blowing because Penn State researcher Zaworski and his colleagues had a newly published study in 2018, I think it's in June, they published it. They reviewed approximately 8.6 million cancer patients in U.S. Wow. Start from 1973 up until all the way 2014. They were approximately the rate of committing suicide was two times more than general population. Now they added from 2002 till today cases, and they found out four times more now.
Did you just say four times more, the average population?
Since 2002, yes.
Since 2002, wow.
Yes. They completed their study, and then added from 2002 to current. And now why that jump from 2002 to now?
Right.
From 2,000
that?
More than now, it's four times more.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty significant. Actually, I was concerned about it. Can it be some kind of a statistical error or something?
Right.
But last week I was in New York in another conference in Sloan Kettering Cancer Center psychiatry, and I asked Dr. Breitbart, he's the chair at there, and he said, no, that's not a statistical error. He says that increased opioid use and the media effect, poor media news content, so violence and bullying and increased financial problems, we just touched on at the beginning, do have impact on this jump.
So you're saying increased opioid use, media effects, sort of negative media content,
like bullying,
violence,
yes,
things like that, and then an increase in financial issues,
yes,
are the reason for the four-time higher suicide rate.
Yes, okay. And in my clinical practices, what I see is as committing suicide thoughts are more like is about negative anticipation and worries,
like
for
about,
the future.
About what's going to happen?
Yes, okay. And they don't want to deal with it. Or intolerable pain sensations. That is something that if they were not getting treated well about their pain and it's significant, that is one of the biggest one. And physical limitations due to cancer treatments, especially the appearances. like they lose their hair, their face, their, you know, they limp, all those things. And feeling loss of control of the situation. They can't control, you know, the situation. Right, right. That's the loss in their life. It's not in their hand anymore. That's the feeling. And then the also, of course, comorbid psychiatric current situation or the history, if they had, you know, several attempts in the past, it really inflicts the situation. Right. And feeling guilty of leaving loved ones behind. That's another one. Okay. So the mostly the, those cancer high types of cancer with highest risk for suicide, mostly it's been addressed in the literature about in the lung cancer, head and neck cancer, testis, bladder cancer, Hodgkin lymphoma. Those are the highest risk types of risk in the, you know, committing suicide.
And why is that?
I think the, you know, the treatments and the outcomes, especially the ones that are in elderly, white, unmarried males, they are really noted is the highest risk.
So elderly, white, unmarried males are at the highest risk.
Yes.
And why is that?
I think that what I can guess is because they are pointing out more like the support system.
And so they're more isolated.
Isolation.
Perhaps, and alone.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Isolation, support system. And, you know, if they don't have anything else to hope in their life to connect and go to, there is no reason for them to, you know, live. That really, I think, make a significant shift in their head that why bother going through this in this life.
That makes sense. I can understand that.
Yeah.
So it really is this combination, though, of sort of pain, adding to their use of pain medicines, and then negative thoughts, and not maybe having an anchoring system and support. And there's just many different factors that are going to be increasing. Our media, like we were saying, it really is a very multifaceted reasoning for why this is
exactly
happening.
Exactly. And we're pointing out elderly, but we should not forget about, the initial diagnosis.
So let's talk about that. So would you say that suicide risk begins with the initial diagnosis?
Yes. There is actually a study about Abum Rad and his colleagues in 2018. They did conduct a study about VA patients from 2002 to 2017. And they found out the most suicide occurred within 7 days of initial diagnosis. Imagine that, 7 days.
Wow.
Within the, especially within the first 24 hours is 41%.
41% within the first 24 hours.
Yes. And then the Johnson and his colleagues in 2011 examined, I think, 3.6 million cancer patients. And they found out that 6,000 committed suicide within that amount of patients that they screened retrospectively. And 36% were within the first year of diagnosis. So the first year is really important in patients committing suicide, as well as the elderly, you know, white unmarried male.
Mm-hmm. So because the first initial diagnosis and delivery and the first year is so important, what are we missing that we need to be doing differently?
I think integrating psycho-oncology is the one that we are missing.
Right.
And it is something, is multi-level issue, lacking issue. One is that we don't get trained in our doctoral degree. There is a psycho-oncology lesson, or have you got any? I didn't.
No.
And
even in health psychology, you didn't get
no,
that?
No. Do you always touch base in general medical situations here and there? But there is a growing population of general survivorships. And this is growing more and more in United States and in general internationally, because the treatments are getting very advanced.
People are living now. That's the thing. People didn't used to have a great
prognosis. I mean, as I mentioned, fourth stage cancer can turn back to, you know, cancer-free in some point. That is a mind-blowing, fascinating situation.
Right.
And so we are facing now how to help these people in terms of what they've been through and what are the psychological aspects of it, you know, they need, and who will be helping them knowing this population.
So are you saying we need to be training more people? I mean, should there be more specialties in our programs? And
yes.
Do we need to be attracting more colleagues to specializing in psycho-oncology?
Definitely the specialized in psycho-oncology clinicians need it. It just right now, I don't know how many exist that going trained and finding themselves with certified and doing the business. Because cancer population is not easy to, you know, just jump in and do.
You just don't hang your shingle out and start doing that.
I don't think.
I would hope not.
It will be a right service
right.
to them.
Right.
You need a supervision. You need to learn the population,
right.
each stages and mm-hmm. how the approach, what kind of technique will be, you know, used. You have to learn and train and educate yourself as a clinician, as well as needs to be some educational outlook exists to get easily and convenient. I mean, that area is lacking. And also oncologists, you know, don't know what is psycho-oncology as well as our colleague. You know, it's rather like 40 years old field. It's still new.
So how do we get physicians to become, because what I'm hearing you say is that physicians don't really know. Perhaps not all of them, but many of them don't really know about this field to the degree that they could.
How do we do that? How would they know? We ourselves don't have that kind of a, you know, education, and how can we expect them to know it?
Right.
You know, it's just not fair that they what they know is the general spectrum, general mental health, but is there any specific psycho-oncology field? I mean, we don't even read it, knowing it. I mean, in East Coast, of course, they are a little more advanced in this. But in here, it's just difficult.
So where could they go to get more information about psycho-oncology if we have listeners who are seeking that treatment or want to find out more about offering it?
I do not know in West Coast. Where do they go get trained? Is there anything out there that give you a training and certification and showing the population and you get supervised by the, you know, the psycho-oncologist psychiatric units? I do not know if it is such a thing exists in here. As I know that, I just went to American Psychosocial Society Conference. That's how I involved in. I went into the conferences, involved learning what are the things out there. And then I found out that, you know, Sloan Kettering is offering certain trainings and certain certifications. And then I got involved in and I asked them, can I come and learn more, and they welcome me, and now they know. I think I'm the only one flying from here to there.
That's just great, though. I mean, that really, I'm sure, makes a huge difference in what you can offer your patients.
Yes, if you're not knowing the area well, you just cannot say, hey, I'm a clinical psychologist, I can treat everything. I think that won't be a serving well to the population.
It seems risky, frankly.
It is
dangerous.
Very risky and
right.
sad situation
yeah.
that you cannot say I'm capable.
Right, right.
You have to go deep in more than that for, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to be specialized about
right.
it.
What advice do you have for clinicians who have patients who they've been treating for other issues and the patients receive a diagnosis? So I've had patients who see me for their regular therapy, but for their specific cancer-related issues, we'll see a psycho-oncologist for that work. But that's not always an option for everybody.
Not really. It's so. Not really an option much. I mean, this is coming like basically word of mouth. Mm-hmm. Or the people interested in going these conferences and specific educations. And as I said, I might be lacking in, if there is such a thing in this area. I don't know. I looked around at that time a few years ago. I didn't know. And I just liked where I'm getting from Sloan Kettering. And I just hooked up and continuing right. with them. I am not sure if it's happening in here anywhere. There is a training, certifications, you know, supervision right. in any doctoral degree program or anywhere else.
Right. Okay. We'll have to do a little research on that one. As we're wrapping up, what are the warning signs for suicide in cancer patients? Obviously, receiving the diagnosis within the first year seems to be an extremely risky time based on the statistics.
Yes.
But what else would you say for caregivers, for if we have physicians listening, other therapists who are just, treating patients and other aspects as well?
As I said, the past history plays a lot of role in there. And all how patients is, you know, been impulsively self-destructive and have a suicidal ideations or attempt in the past or any comorbid like bipolar or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, any other issues they had in the past and delivering to you that they actually did attempt has a warning sign on there. But as we all know, as a clinician, there is no cut, you know, straight route to this person going to commit suicide. That right. person will not. There is no such a thing.
That's right.
What I do when I see people, warning sign is just usually that when they don't see the, you know, anything to live for. That is a very significant thing for me at that time. There is no meaning in life. Mm-hmm. There is nothing to live for. And at that time, I just look around and surrounding who is taking care of them and try to connect them into the sessions or make them aware that giving extra supervision around while they're getting treatments and things.
Right. Yeah, I think it's so, suicide, I always say, you don't just take yourself, you take everyone who loves with you in some level, because it really does ripple effect people that you love when you lose someone to suicide in your family. You know, you might be not be here anymore, but the rest of us are still here. It's pretty horrific and gut-wrenching, and everyone has a right to their own life and decisions, I believe.
Exactly.
But at the same time, like we've talked about, there are many ways to, potentially live a life that's of quality until you are no longer here in whatever form that takes.
Right.
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 So in our last minute or so, what else would you like to share about your passion for psycho-oncology? And then I'll have you tell us how our listeners can find you.
What I can share is that as a last ending conclusion that we must be really aware of that while an oncology team tries to rescue the body and, get rid of the tumor, a patient's emotion might be working on taking his or her life away. So suicidal attempts can be a very serious thing, and oncologists or the other medical staffs might not be aware that the back burner is happening. So from the initial diagnosis, suggesting them to involve in psychotherapy. Sometimes patient doesn't come. They refer, patients to therapy, but they don't come in a way that I think they still make it available out there for them, the names and referrals from their various, people, mental health people, professionals out there, whoever, they can afford and go. Or they think it's suitable, it will be a good thing to, make them available. And how they reach to me is I have a website. They can reach me from there. And also I'm in Newport Beach. They can search me, Chidam Coyle, clinical psychologist. I'll be there and all my information is there.
So tell us how to spell your name and what your website is, please.
Okay, my name's Chidam. It's a very tough name, I know.
That's okay, we got it.
Okay, Cigdem, and my last name is Coyle, Coyle.
Okay, and is that your website?
My website is Dr. Coyle, dot com. That is one of them. And if they just clicked on me as Chidam Coil Anxiety, I will probably pop up there.
Okay. And what is the best phone number to reach you?
Okay. My best number is only number 310-717-3366.
Wonderful.
This is for everyone.
Great. Whether we're just having anxiety or we have something else going on.
Or everyone. I don't have any second one.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Coil.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It was wonderful to have you. And I think a very, very important topic.
Thank you.
I hope we can keep spreading the word on the importance of prioritizing mental health treatment in cancer treatments. I think it's something that we're not talking about enough. So thank you.
I hope so. Thank you.
Yes. You've been listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, a clinical psychologist. And this show explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on KX93.5. Please remember that everything we talked about tonight is not meant to serve as a therapeutic relationship, but really just meant to provide information. But if you are in need of mental health treatment, please do not hesitate to seek a provider who can help you. And I'm happy to send resources if needed. Thank you so much, and have a beautiful evening, Laguna Beach, and all of our listeners. And I will see you next week. Take care.